We have another patient who shared her story with us. Barbara, a patient of Dr. Kuzel's from Vernon Hills, Illinois, was already a breast cancer survivor twice when she was diagnosed with metastatic kidney cancer. She's had good success treating the kidney cancer with sunitinib.
I've decided in my mind that when you have cancer, you can never say it's totally gone.
Whoa, good one.
But if I can live and function, it's not keeping me from doing anything.
Here we go. Woo! Good one.
I was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 49 years old. I had a lump on the top of my left breast. The surgeon said it had to come out. I did need chemotherapy, and I also needed radiation. You know, then I was clear of cancer for a number of years. I never thought, after the first time, I never thought I'd get cancer. I just never thought I could get it again. I mean, I knew you could, but I never thought I would. I have CAT scans every certain amount of months. They saw that there was a tumor on my kidney. I had kidney cancer.
Knowing that she had the cancer was really hard for me, naturally, because we were like more like sisters than even friends. It never seemed to really affect her that much, and she just took it all in stride. And as a friend, I just helped her get through it.
They felt that the best way to do this was to remove the whole kidney. And I had a very quick recovery. After the kidney was removed, there was no other treatment. The cancer was gone. When I had breast cancer for the second time, it was 6 years later than I had the breast cancer the first time. I had the second kidney cancer. About 5 or 5.5 years from when I was diagnosed with the second breast cancer. I definitely had symptoms to send me to the doctor right away. I had a little bleeding, and I thought, well, you know, what's a little bleeding? It's not a big deal. Maybe it's something with a urinary tract infection. So I let it go. But then the next day at work, when I went to the bathroom, there was a whole toilet full of blood.
We're going to start the scan now.
It metastasized to 4 organs. And it was in my lung, my liver, my stomach, and the kidney. I was told that it's 4th stage. He said, but patients can live for, you know, a number of years. When I left there then, just going home, thinking about what was going to be the treatment I was going to take, the first thing I thought of was, I'm not even going to see my granddaughter be bat mitzvahed.
B is for Big Bird, and S is for Sydney.
When I was given the 2 choices of treatment, one of the options was having infusion in the hospital. You're actually in intensive care. I really knew that I didn't want to do that, if at all possible. However, I did feel if that's the only way, then I would have done it. I decided to go along with the oral form of chemo. I started out on 50 milligrams. It was one pill that I took every morning for 4 weeks. After the 4 weeks, I would stop taking it for 2 weeks. And then at the end of the 2 weeks, I would go to see the doctor, and then I'd go back on it again. But I did have loss of appetite. Things tasted terrible to me. I had very terrible sores in my mouth, lining my tongue. It was almost 2 years.
Yeah.
I might be on it for the rest of my life, as long as it's doing its job.
To your health.
Thank you, and to yours.
The only side effect I really have now is pretty much the diarrhea. I consider myself pretty lucky. No matter what I've gone through, it doesn't matter. I'm still here to talk about it. I did actually just recently contact the Cancer Wellness Center.
Come on in and I'll show you where we're going to work.
To start doing something to help other people. I'm also going to be handing out pamphlets from the Cancer Wellness Center. They'll give me a list of internist office to be able to put them in. I feel that I'm a very fortunate person. I've said it, I've been saying it for years, and I just see it more and more.
Whoa, this is hard to do this one.
I think Barbara's situation nicely illustrates the kinds of discussions that medical oncologists have to have with patients nowadays. There are a number of different treatment options that could have been considered in Barbara's case, as she mentioned in that piece. We initially discussed whether there was a therapy that could be curative for advanced disease. And we talked about interleukin-2, which we'll talk about a little bit later in more detail. And although the response rates or tumor shrinkage rates are significant with IL-2, the toxicity, the requirement for an inpatient hospital stay certainly are a little bit more impressive for patients. And she had had breast cancer twice. Her second primary breast cancer was in her opposite breast about a year after her kidney had been resected. And although she's about 5 or 6 years from her breast cancer experience, with the involvement that she had at this point in time, we just felt like we didn't want to take a chance that the interleukin 2 wouldn't work fast enough. And we ultimately settled on an oral agent administered as an outpatient, and hopefully she would tolerate it well. And she's done marvelously. She's been on it for several years. And I think that it illustrates nicely how important some of these new agents have been in the treatment of patients.
So if I had a patient like Barbara in my clinic, I'd also give her sunitinib. I think over the last couple of years, the data for sunitinib in first-line clear cell carcinoma is the clearest and sort of the most robust. In studies that were published in the New England Journal of Medicine last year, led by Robert Motzer from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, that trial group showed that sunitinib, as compared to interferon in patients with clear cell carcinoma, had an improvement in progression-free survival, 11 months for the sunitinib, 5 months for the interferon, a 6 months difference in time to progression or progression-free survival. Also, for the first time, we saw an agent such as sunitinib cause tumor reduction or size of the tumor shrink, where 31% of the patients had reduction in the size of their tumors, meeting criteria for a response, whereas only 6% of those patients in the interferon arm, which is consistent with the data that we've seen for many years.
I think, Mike, you bring up a good point, as in the primary tumor shrinkage. And I've used this agent, along with a medical oncologist, to attempt to resect previously unresectable disease by shrinking the tumor burden. But I have been stymied occasionally by patients' cardiac risk factors. And Tim, what's your, how do you adequately, or how do you determine whether a patient is a candidate for sunitinib based on their cardiac risk factors?
These drugs are thought to work basically on the blood vessels, not on the tumor cells exactly. And interestingly, in the trials with both sunitinib as well as sorafenib, hypertension has often been seen in patients, and the elevation in blood pressure can be actually quite dramatic. Some patients who have pre-existing blood pressure problems may require 2 or 3 drugs to try to control their blood pressure. In the earlier sunitinib studies, there was also a suggestion of some decline in cardiac function, and thus, at least in my practice, for patients who have difficult to control high blood pressure or pre-existing cardiac dysfunction, I'm a little bit hesitant to consider sunitinib, and some of the other approaches may be a preferred approach.
Speaking of which, what about other medical options?
Well, again, she's a good risk patient based on those clinical features that we had talked about. There are some other drugs which have also recently been approved. There is a class of agents called the mTOR inhibitors, which, again, we're not totally sure of the mechanism, but there seems to be a relationship between that pathway in tumor cells and the ability of tumor cells to drive blood vessel proliferation. There has been a large study that was done, a phase 3 randomized trial, where a drug called temsirolimus was compared with interferon alpha or a combination of interferon plus temsirolimus. Now, that was in the poor-risk population. They had to have 3 or more of those clinical features. But that is the only trial recently that's been done with some of our new drugs, which has demonstrated a conclusive survival benefit for patients receiving the new drug. If she had fit into that risk group of patients, that would certainly have been a consideration. In general, however, for a good or intermediate risk patient such as Barbara, I would have leaned in a different direction.
Yeah, just to follow up on the temsirolimus data, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, the survival for patients with poor risk factors is around 8 months, and the study confirmed that the interferon alone group had a survival of about 7.3 months, whereas those patients who got the temsirolimus lived 10.9 months median survival. So a 3 month, 3.5 month improvement in survival for these poorest of risk patients, and that's what really let the FDA go ahead and approve this for our patients with kidney cancer. Since that time, the other agent is bevacizumab interferon, more like the other studies looking at an endpoint of progression-free survival rather than overall survival. Bevacizumab interferon is a natural combination of a blood vessel inhibitor targeting VEGF in combination with an immune therapy. And those studies primarily done in France, a follow-up study, a subsequent study that was reported done here in the States, showed that bevacizumab interferon versus interferon also had an improvement in progression-free survival. Mm-hmm. And those numbers are really roughly the same as sunitinib versus interferon, about a 10.5-month progression-free survival for patients on the combination as compared to about 5.5 months for those patients receiving interferon alone.
Like most cancer treatments, these medications do have side effects. Barbara, the patient we met a little earlier, developed some long-term problems associated with sunitinib.
They found out that I had developed high blood pressure, which I never had. I also developed thyroid problem. So I'm on medication for both of those, too. And they say that they're pseudo. But due to the medication, it can cause that.
Is this a typical experience?
Well, we talked about some of the cardiovascular effects earlier of these agents, and Barbara certainly developed high blood pressure, which she had never experienced before. There's a number of other side effects, though, that she also has experienced, which can be a significant problem for patients. She mentioned diarrhea as an ongoing chronic problem. We often will give patients anti-diarrheal agents to try to control that, but they have limited efficacy, unfortunately. Fatigue becomes a problem for patients, both acutely but also chronically. In the patients that I have, I usually will check thyroid function because some patients do develop true hypothyroidism from these agents and may benefit from treatment for hypothyroidism. Nausea is usually less of an issue for this problem. Pain, especially mouth pain or pain from a rash on the palms and soles, can actually be quite debilitating and is very difficult to treat. And there are no standard approaches that we have yet developed for this.
I think it's important to note that sunitinib, sorafenib are oral agents, and oral agents people think have less side effects. But as Tim just went through, you have a list of things that really do need to be followed and are quite manageable. When you move to a drug like temsirolimus, which is an IV drug, once a week has to be administered, you're often in the clinic, and so you're seen by nurses during those visits. But there are a set of toxicities that you can see with temsirolimus, such as a rash. It's usually red, sort of global on the trunk or arms. You can get fatigue, sores in the mouth, not true ulcerations, but soreness, nausea, some edema of the lower extremities also been noted. You do see some abnormalities in blood tests, particularly you can see hyperglycemia, hyperlipidemia, hypertriglyceridemia. You can see lymphopenia, and most of that, if it's symptomatic or higher than one would like or sort of feel is appropriate for that patient over time, again, medicines can be instituted either to control the sugars or to control the lipids. And so that's one of the first things that we really are following with these patients over time. But we don't see the cardiovascular effects, the hand-foot syndrome that we see with the oral agents. There is a rare toxicity of pulmonary fibrosis, so if patients start to have cough or other symptoms, we do recommend either a chest x-ray and maybe even a follow-up with a pulmonologist.
So, Mike, how do you best deal with these side effects? I know they can be troublesome to the patients and their quality of life.
Yeah, I think our goal really is to get patients to take the therapy as long as possible, as long as they can tolerate them. And in some cases, we do have to do dose reductions. Sunitinib, sorafenib have certainly standard algorithms for dose reduction that still allows the patient to get an adequate amount of the drug and target the pathways. Temsirolimus also has sort of recommendations for that. Sometimes we have to give patients drug holidays. So sunitinib's already dosed in such a way that we give patients 4 weeks of the drug and then a two-week holiday. So those may either have to be extended or with dose reductions.
I think these illustrate all of the relatively common and probably manageable side effects with these agents. Bevacizumab has been around for some other diseases as well as kidney cancer. And unfortunately, we've recognized that these agents which target the blood vessels often are associated with a risk of bleeding or blood clotting, and even some very dangerous side effects such as perforation of the GI tract. This becomes an issue for us sometimes when a patient develops a need for relatively emergent surgical procedures. Ben, do you have a routine recommendation for patients who are on these agents who might need surgery?
Well, as you mentioned, in the general surgical literature, there are incidences of bowel perforation, delayed wound healing, and the like. Anecdotally, what I found in my practice and other practices that I've discussed this with is that occasionally these patients will have spontaneous hemorrhage that presumably has to be resulted from the medication. Epistaxis, even an obturator artery bleed, somewhat bizarre things that have required transfusion. So what I've done is, and I think most people would agree with me, try to stop the TKI inhibitor, the VEGF inhibitor, 3 weeks prior to the operative date. What I have found in those situations is not necessarily a problem with bleeding, per se, but if there's been a remarkable shrinkage in the primary tumor, there is some adhesion formation of the bowel, the omentum, and the like that makes surgery a little bit more technically difficult.
We've discussed first-line therapy, appropriate patient selection, and how to help patients stay with their treatments. But what about second-line therapy if disease progresses?
Yeah, I think, you know, that really is an area of excitement as well because we have all of these new agents. Sorafenib was the drug that started it all in terms of the targeted era. It was the first approved, and it was approved based on a study that was tested in the second-line setting. So patients who had cytokines or interferon or interleukin-2 as their primary therapy were randomized to sorafenib or placebo, and in that study, the target study, patients had a 12-week longer time to progression for sorafenib as compared to the placebo group, and that was enough and excitement based on sort of limited options for patients to get sorafenib approved for patients with advanced renal cell carcinoma. But then we have the data in first-line settings with sunitinib, the temsirolimus data, the bevacizumab interferon data, and all of a sudden we now have 4 or 5 agents plus a whole pipeline of drugs that are coming through our clinical trial portfolio that all of a sudden second-line therapy has a lot more questions about what is the right drug, what's the right order, and I think it really is prime for asking clinical trials.